So, of course, it's a pleasure and an honor to speak here today. Primarily, I'm going to be giving a sort of broad overview of my thoughts on the subject, sort of involving at least partly some work that came out last year with Jeevan Chandra, Scott Collier, and Tom Hartman, as well as I'll share some work in progress with Viraj Marulia and Mark Van Ranstonk. I don't know who that is. as well as with Jojeep Chakravarti and Kevan Namju at McGill. So let me start by just giving a rather general overview. So really, I think we've come to appreciate that the most important tool in our study of quantum gravity right now is holography, which is an equivalence between gravity in anti-de Sitter space and conformal field theory. And this is supposed to be an exact equivalence at a quantum level, meaning that the Hilbert spaces of those two theories are supposed to agree, the Hamiltonians agree, the partitions agree, and so forth. And although this has allowed us to answer many deep and interesting questions, there is a puzzle, I think, that has been sort of brewing in the background for the last 20 years or so, and has really come to the fore in the last couple of years, which involves the presence of Euclidean wormholes in typical theories of gravity. And these are Euclidean solutions that connect disconnected boundaries, disconnected asymptotically ADS boundaries in Euclidean signature, that present a puzzle for the following reason. So let's imagine that we had a solution of the equations of motion that connected two boundaries that I've denoted sigma 1 and sigma 2 here. At least very naively, these would lead the partition function of the theory, if you consider it as a function of the boundary data, so one boundary over here, one boundary over here, in the gravitational theory, it wouldn't factorize. But for every normal conformal field theory, say, defined by a path integral of some sort, almost by definition, this would factorize. And this at least is something that I initially appreciated as a puzzle due to a very prescient paper of Maldacena and Maus. I mean, just as a historical note, I have a reputation as someone who works on 3D gravity a lot. That's the paper that started getting me interested in 3D gravity, initially because I just didn't believe, I didn't want to have to think about these wormholes. And so I started working on 3D gravity in order to figure out why I just didn't have to worry about them. Okay, that turned out not to be the case. In fact, I should have been worried about wormholes. And in fact, I'm very glad that I was. So in the last several years, a resolution of this puzzle has really presented itself, which is that the interpretation is that the gravitational theory that you're studying when you find one of these wormhole solutions is not dual to an individual conformal field theory, but rather to a probability distribution on the space of conformal field theories. And what we call the gravity partition function is really the average of the corresponding conformal field theory quantity averaged with some probability distribution. So for example, that two-boundary wormhole is really computing something like the variance of some observable across the space of conformal field theories. Now, of course, this picture that I think was first really made precise in lovely work of Saad, Schenker, and Stanford in the context of two-dimensional gravity really presents many questions. So for example, what is this probability distribution? Where does the averaging come from the point of view of some UV complete theory of quantum gravity, such as string theory? And do we even really need to care? I should also, before we get into any details, mention just a few words on the interpretation of this ensemble averaging, which is that, of course, an exact UV-complete theory of quantum gravity is not dual to some non-trivial ensemble on the space of conformal field theories, but rather to an individual conformal field theory. And these ensembles seem to emerge only when we approximate fancy UV-complete theories of gravity by relatively simple theories of gravity, things like general relativity or other theories that can be described by some kind of path integral. And really, the way that I at least have made peace with this is that we really shouldn't worry about that too much. at least if you're studying a sufficiently complicated theory, that the theory is chaotic. Because in a chaotic theory, this sort of averaging procedure is essentially harmless. Okay? And the magic words you're supposed to say to yourself are the words self-averaging. Right? Because the idea is that each member of this ensemble on the space of conformal field theories is more or less inequivalent, more or less equivalent to every other member of that ensemble, at least if you're looking at sort of sufficiently coarse-grained observables that aren't sensitive to the sort of e to the minus s microstructure in the theory. You know, you're supposed to think in your head of a spin glass or something like that, a very complicated quantum mechanical Hamiltonian that has an exponentially dense set of states, which can, at a very coarse level, be described not by an individual Hamiltonian, but by an ensemble of Hamiltonians with some probability distribution on the space of couplings. Okay. But the remarkable thing is that even after this averaging, a lot of the structure of the original theory is still visible in the average theory, things like level repulsion, level statistics, stuff like that. But that, of course, really begs the question of how does that ultraviolet complete theory, the true theory of quantum gravity, recover a single CFT? That is to say, how does it kill the wormhole if, in the low-energy coarse-grained theory, apparently there is such a solution? Okay. So here's my plan for today. First, I'm going to tell you that despite what you might think, you really shouldn't ignore these wormholes. They're really quite ubiquitous. Then I'll try and convince you that you should be glad you didn't ignore wormholes. Not only couldn't you ignore them, they're a crucial piece of our understanding how it is that semi-classical gravity emerges from some ultraviolet complete theory of quantum gravity. I'll talk a little bit about their Lorentzian continuation and how we interpret them in terms of baby universes. And then I'll say some rather speculative words at the end about how they might disappear in a UV complete theory. Okay, so let's begin. So let me begin by just giving you a little bit of intuition for why wormholes are so ubiquitous in all sorts of theories of gravity. So remember, a Euclidean wormhole is something that connects two different asymptotic boundaries. And a simple example might be a solution where you write the metric in an FRW-like form. I say it's FRW-like because I have a plus sign instead of a minus sign, so that I have a Euclidean metric, but I'm parameterizing it in terms of some scale factor A of t. And then if we were to write down the equations of motion of the theory, there would be an analog of the FRW equation. So we all hopefully remember the FRW equation in Lorentzian signature. It says that A dot over A is equal to an energy density. Here, I've used the fact that I have a negative cosmological constant. So there's a negative term here. And then you add in the energy density of all the rest of the stuff in the theory. Okay. Now, if you take T to IT, that essentially flips the sign of this equation. So you've got a positive term that needs to be canceled by your energy density. And in order to find a wormhole, what we need is a bounce. We need some t equals zero slice over here where a dot is equal to zero. And you're only going to find that if you've got enough energy in the problem. So you'll have a bounce if rho is sufficiently large. Okay. Now, let's give a simple example just to develop some intuition. So let's imagine that we have a field, say a scalar field phi. Okay. Then what sort of terms would there be in this energy density? Well, you might have a kinetic energy. You might have an energy that comes from the gradients of the field. And you might have some potential energy. And when you take T to IT, the sign of this term is going to flip, but the other two terms are going to be positive. Okay? And so what these three terms are telling you about are really three different ways that you could imagine building a wormhole. One way you could build a wormhole would be from this potential energy term. That is to say, if you just had a lump of mass somewhere in your geometry that carried energy, then you could imagine building a wormhole from that. A second way of building a wormhole would be not to have a lump of mass, but to have energy coming from the spatial gradients of the scalar fields. Okay? That's another way you can get a wormhole. And finally, a third way that you could get a wormhole is you could try and get a positive energy from that kinetic energy term there. And of course, for normal scalar fields, that's not going to work because this is negative density. So you need to do something kind of funny. And that's what these axion wormholes are. Axions are fields that pick up an I when you go to Euclidean signature. So in fact, this term would be a positive definite here. And all of these methods work. Okay. So let's just talk very briefly about some examples of wormholes we can construct. So let's imagine a wormhole constructed from some potential energy. So the simplest possible thing you could do is just take a collection of point particles. Okay? So what would this be? This would be an energy density that has a bunch of delta functions times some masses that would be located at some points in space. And this would describe a wormhole of the type that I've drawn here. Okay? So here, again, I've written down the exact solution. We have this bounce factor A of t that has a bounce. And my spatial geometry is just the spatial geometry that you get if you throw in a bunch of point particles. Okay? In particular here, I'm talking about gravity in three dimensions. And so that spatial geometry, you need to solve for it. And it turns out that the solution is rather simple. The spatial geometry has constant negative curvature except at the location of the particles. And there's one final ingredient, which is that if I want the spatial geometry to have the topology of a sphere, I need to respect the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, which says that the integral of the curvature over that sphere has to be positive. And that gives me a bound on the masses. So in some units, it's just that the sum of the masses needs to be bigger than one. Okay? So if you take a bunch of particles with enough mass, then you can find a wormhole. Okay? And in this case, because point masses source conical defects in 2 plus 1 gravity, this just looks like a wormhole where the spatial slice is hyperbolic with some isolated conical defects. And this would be interpreted as leading to a variance in the correlation functions of these operators. In this picture, it would be a variance of a three-point function. Now, of course, it's easy to generalize this. And I think one very nice way of thinking about this is that you could actually, instead of having a couple of isolated point particles, you could smear it out and have some sort of continuous energy density. And the only constraint would be that the total amount of energy needs to be bigger than one in some units. So in the most extreme example, you could imagine coarse graining a bunch of small particles with very small mass that are evenly distributed over the sphere. And then this energy density would be a constant. And you would have a wormhole that on very small distance scales might look like you have a bunch of isolated point particles, but on longer distance scales would just look like you have a sphere. So this would be a wormhole that looks like a sphere times Euclidean time. And in fact, it turns out you can approximate any two-dimensional metric this way. Something that was, I think, first emphasized to me by Mark Van Ramsdonk, not Van Rams, Van Ransdonk. And what would the interpretation of this be in our dual conformal field theory? Well, it would mean that there's a variance for correlation functions, not just of heavy operators, but of light operators. In particular, because I would need to satisfy this condition here on the energy, you would need to have lots and lots of light operators. So for example, we saw earlier that the three-point function of some heavy operators would have a variance. Now it would be the n-point function of some light operators would have a variance. And if you go through the counting in the 2D CFT example, if you took an operator with mass or dimension of order one, then the c-point function, where c is the central charge, is something that would have a variance. Okay. So I sort of like this analogy to QED, where you think of electron-electron scattering as being a weakly coupled process because the fine structure constant is 1 over 137, which is small. So that's a problem that you can give to a field theory student. But the scattering of 137 electrons off of each other is not something you give a field theory student. You give it to a condensed matter theorist instead. Okay, that's like a strongly coupled problem. And it's these sort of correlation functions that would acquire a variance. And of course, it's also possible to construct wormholes out of spatial gradients. This was very nicely discussed in this 90-page paper of Maralf and Santos. One of the most remarkable things is that although that paper is 90 pages, it just sort of scratched the surface of the kind of wormholes that you can build. And here I've outlined, I've sort of sketched an example of a sort of wormhole that you can build with some spatial gradient energy, okay? So here the scale factor, again, has this bounce form and the profile of the scalar fields, you know, it has some nice non-trivial profile. The upshot of this is that although you might be tempted to think of Euclidean wormholes as some weird, exotic objects that it would be perfectly okay to ignore, in fact, that's not the case. You can't ignore them. They're everywhere. Almost anything you try and do, subject to those conditions I outlined earlier, will lead you to some kind of Euclidean wormhole solution. Okay. But you should be glad that you can't ignore wormholes, because in fact, they're crucial for our understanding of how semi-classical gravity emerges from UV complete theories. So I remind you, as we discussed earlier, that in a theory with wormholes, the dual is some kind of distribution on the space of conformal field theories. So in order to understand that, we need to develop a theory of random conformal field theory analogous to the theory of random matrices. So the first thing that we need to do is understand how to parameterize the space of field of CFTs. And the data that we use to define a CFT is a spectrum, that is to say a set of operator dimensions and spins, along with a set of coupling constants as packaged into the OPE coefficients. And you can't just choose these freely. They're subject to all sorts of complicated constraints, usually referred to as the bootstrap constraints. Things like modular invariance, crossing symmetry of correlation functions, and so forth. Okay. So of course, here I've written down the classic invariance of the OPE coefficients under S-channel crossing. This is a quadratic constraint on the OPE coefficients. Now, if we try and investigate the space of solutions of these equations, you quickly discover that the space of conformal field theories is a weird and wild place. It has both discrete and connected components, but it's expected that a typical conformal field theory is an isolated point. It can't be continuously deformed to some neighboring conformal field theory. But just by constructing relatively simple sets of examples, you can convince yourself that there are a vast number of solutions of these bootstrap constraints. So for example, you can construct a number of examples as a function of central charge that grows faster than factorially. Okay, it grows like e to the c squared log c, not c log c. Okay. And in fact, I would conjecture that this is an estimate for the total number of conformal field theories in two dimensions as a function of central charge. Okay. Now, there are two kinds of conjectures that one can make. They're the conjectures that you make because you believe that they're true, and they're the conjectures that you make because you know the best way to get people to work on something is to try and prove you wrong. I won't tell you what sort of conjecture this is, but anyway, I'm making this conjecture. Okay, good. Here, I should just mention that because I expect the typical conformal field theory to be isolated, I've written this as a sum over conformal field theories, weighted by 1 over the number of symmetries of the CFT. We can discuss why that is if you like. But there are also continuous families of conformal field theories. When you have a family of CFTs, there's a natural metric on the space of CFTs known as the Zamolodnikov metric, and I would integrate those connected components with respect to the measure associated to that metric. Now, having discussed the space of conformal field theories, let's think about what probability distribution it would be natural to define on this space. And I would say that whenever we talk about probability distributions, there's always only one probability distribution we should ever talk about, which is the maximum entropy one. And so again, here's another conjecture. I won't tell you whether it's a type 1 or type 2 conjecture, but the conjecture is that general relativity in anti-de Sitter space is dual to the maximum entropy probability distribution over the space of solutions of the CFT bootstrap. And I'll point out that if this conjecture were true, it would have striking consequences about the structure of quantum field theories. So for example, in two dimensions, general CFTs in two dimensions are dual to general relativity in ADS. General relativity in ES has a gap in the spectrum between empty space and the lightest black hole. This would correspond to a gap in the spectrum of primary operators in a two-dimensional CFT of order the central charge. And this conjecture would say that not only do there exist such conformal field theories with a large gap, but they're in fact typical. This is in tension with the fact that we know of no examples of them. Okay. And then, of course, general relativity is conjectured to be dual to the maximum entropy probability distribution. And other fancier theories of gravity would, of course, also be dual to maximum entropy probability distributions, but now subject to more constraints. And in fact, I can reinterpret some work that I and others did a couple years ago now in this language. It turns out that there's one reasonably simple example where I can carry out this procedure exactly, which is not the space of generic two-dimensional conformal field theories, but two-dimensional conformal field theories with a giant set of symmetries that allow us to solve the theory exactly. In that case, it turns out that the space of conformal field theories is a finite dimensional space. It's a space of dimension n squared. Here n is the central charge. And this space of conformal field theories is a homogeneous symmetric space. There's a natural maximum entropy probability distribution on this space, which is just the flat measure with respect to this symmetries of that space. And with that homogeneous measure, you can compute averages and you get something that looks like a theory of gravity. Okay. So it looks like a theory of gravity in the sense of this very exciting equation. One reason this equation is exciting is I figured out how to put images in line in a tech equation, which is very exciting. Another reason why this equation is exciting is that here I'm imagining computing the average of observable over the space of CFTs. Here, the observable is the partition function on a surface, and it looks like a sum over ways of filling in that surface with three manifolds. Okay. So this is one simple example where a maximum entropy probability distribution really gives you answers that look like they come from a theory of gravity. Now, that theory of gravity is not general relativity. It's something much, much simpler. But if we want to get general relativity, we're going to have to do something more sophisticated. And so because solving all the constraints of crossing symmetry is hard, I'm going to make my life easier by just solving some but not all of the constraints, the bootstrap constraints. So for example, you can just look at S-channel crossing, okay? And that gives you one constraint on the spectrum of the theory, namely a Cardy density of heavy states, as well as a constraint on the OPE coefficients of the theory, namely that their squares have to, when you coarse grain a little bit, achieve some particular asymptotic form whose exact functional form isn't so important for me right now, but which is related to Liouville theory. And I should emphasize that this is a constraint of crossing. So at this point, these are just formulas that are true of every individual conformal field theory if you look at the coarse-grained features of the high-energy states in the theory. But now what I want to do is reinterpret those statistical constraints on individual conformal field theories as defining a distribution on the space of CFTs. So in particular, I want the maximum entropy distribution on the data that defines a conformal field theory that solves S-channel crossing. So what does that mean? It means I need a Cardy density of heavy states, and because my constraint here was on the square of the OPE coefficients, a Gaussian distribution of OPE coefficients. This is a maximum entropy probability distribution because if I have a random variable and I specify its mean and its variance, the maximum entropy probability distribution is a Gaussian. Okay. And this is the ensemble that we studied in our paper of last year. The claim, then, is that this ensemble is dual to general relativity in ADS, pure gravity in ADS, coupled to point particles with a caveat. Okay. What do I mean when I say it's dual to gravity in ADS? I mean that the ensemble average of any observable that I can compute is given by the action of Einstein gravity. For every boundary observable for which I know how to identify the corresponding dual classical geometry. And there's an important caveat that I'll return to later, which is that this is only up to a particular choice of channel decomposition. So for example, we could imagine computing the variance of that OPE coefficient squared. And what do you find? You find that in the semi-classical limit, it's exactly the action of that wormhole that I told you about 15 minutes ago. So not only shouldn't we have ignored that wormhole, we're glad we didn't ignore the wormhole. Because if we didn't ignore the wormhole, we would have never been able to understand the dual of 2 plus 1 general relativity. And of course, this works for much more general observables than just that variance of the three-point coefficient. So for example, you could imagine studying a CFT on this genus 2 surface. Okay. When you write that in terms of the OPE coefficient, it's a sum of squares of OPE coefficients. Why is that? It's because you can think of a genus 2 surface as two spheres that are each glued together on three points. And you have to let operators propagate between the two spheres along those three points. So you get a square of a three-point coefficient. You compute its average in that ensemble, and you get the action of some classical saddle point. We can now do even fancier things. So for example, if you want to compute the average of the square of that partition function, you're now computing the average of a fourth power of the OPE coefficients. And as always, if you're computing the average of a fourth power of a Gaussian random variable, you have to sum over the Wick contractions between those random variables. And the sum over those Wick contractions reproduces, at least part of, the sum over geometries in a gravitational theory. So for example, you have this quantity here, which is just the square of that. So that's just the sum of two disconnected saddle points. And then we have the term where one of these guys Wick contracts with one of those guys, and that gives you a wormhole. Okay. Now, I'm reproducing only some of the terms in the sum over geometries from a gravity path integral, because I only started out by solving some of the constraints of crossing symmetry, not all of them. And what we really need to do is to refine our probability distribution to impose more and more constraints of crossing, and then you'll get more and more of the terms in the sum over geometry. Okay. Now, at the level of the spectrum, I think there's an obvious guess for how to do that. There's a modular invariant version of Cardy's formula that you could use. And then at the level of the OPE coefficients, you need to include some sort of non-Gaussianities. Let me give you just an aside on the interpretation of this. So you might ask, where does this ensemble averaging come from? Well, here's where I think it comes from. You could imagine thinking about a single UV complete theory in higher dimensions. And then the coarse graining over black hole microstates in that theory, at least if you consider an appropriate set of black holes, would give you some sort of ADS near horizon region. And there would be some low dimensional theory of ADS gravity describing that near horizon dynamics. And I would say that this ensemble averaging in our lower dimensional ADS space is a remnant of this coarse graining over black hole microstates in the parent theory. And there's a sense in which we already saw this explicitly in our three-dimensional example. Since we replaced an average over the heavy states, that is to say, the black hole microstates of this theory, by an average over an ensemble of couplings. Good. So that's hopefully convinced you that not only are wormholes something you can't ignore, but they're something that you need. I'd now like to spend a little bit more time thinking about the interpretation of these wormholes. So the first point that I'd like to make is that although we talked about wormholes with multiple boundaries so far in this talk, there are also wormholes with a single boundary. Okay? And in general, I expect this is always the case, that if you've got a theory which has multi-boundary wormholes, then there are also going to be single boundary geometries that have a handle that connects two points in the bulk, which you would call a bulk wormhole rather than a wormhole connecting different boundaries. So for example, I can take that three-point wormhole that I drew for you earlier, and it turns out that you can just take this little cap here. So this is supposed to be a circle with a cap that goes into the Euclidean geometry. It's what you might call a dome, and another dome over here. And it turns out there's another three-dimensional geometry where you identify those domes. And that's a geometry that looks something like this. It's a theory with only a single boundary, because this circle is now identified with this circle. It's got four operator insertions on the boundary, and it's got a particle that goes on a loop in the bulk. Okay. And so this is a geometry that you might draw like this, that has a single boundary but a handle in the bulk. Okay. And the natural question to ask is, what happens if you imagine computing things, including the contribution of those bulk wormholes? So you could imagine starting with a theory of gravity with non-interacting particles and computing a four-point function, including now in the sum over geometries, this bulk wormhole. Okay? So the leading contribution would just be the one where nothing interesting happens between these operators. But now there's going to be a second geometry that involves these particles going through that handle. Notice in this example, my particles don't ever interact. Okay? Their only role in life is to support this, give you enough energy in order to support the existence of this wormhole. But when you study this thing, you actually observe something remarkable, which is that I can view the existence of this wormhole as instead a coupling between those different three species of particles with the disorder average for the coupling. Okay. So in particular, it turns out that the answer for that wormhole is exactly what you would get if you had a disorder average in my bulk theory. So my conclusion is that not only do we have an average over OPE coefficients, over CFTs in the bulk, but you should think about this, an average over CFTs from the boundary point of view, but you should think about this as a theory where you have an effective field theory in ADS whose couplings are random variables, okay, due to the presence of single boundary wormholes. So my claim is that in any theory of gravity with these single boundary wormholes, the bulk effective field theory is a theory with random couplings. And of course, this is just a reasonably tractable version of an old idea going back to Coleman and Gitting-Strominger, which is that when you integrate out wormholes and you view that from the low energy point of view of someone in effective field theory, it looks like you have random couplings. So you imagine some bilocal term coming from integrating out wormholes that looks like the presence of random couplings, in this case pulled from a Gaussian distribution. And so what we've seen is that three-dimensional gravity is a theory where precisely this happens. Now, of course, how do we interpret those bulk wormholes? Well, it turns out you can interpret those bulk wormholes in terms of entanglement with a baby universe. Okay? So here I've given you another example of such a bulk wormhole. Here, this is the genus 2 wormhole, except I've glued together a dome here with a dome here. Now, if I want to give a Lorentzian signature interpretation to this geometry, the first thing I need to do is find the surface of vanishing extrinsic curvature, so I can glue it onto a Lorentzian spacetime. Okay? In this case, my boundary is genus 4. It's genus 2 glued to genus 2. But my surface of vanishing extrinsic curvature includes that red surface there, because it's variant under T to minus T symmetry, okay, which is a baby universe, a compact universe of genus 2. But it turns out that this red dome is also part of the surface of vanishing extrinsic curvature. So what this wormhole is doing for you is it's preparing an entangled state. And it's an entangled state where you entangle an ADS with a baby universe. Okay? So we're used to thinking about things like the thermofield double, where you entangle an ADS with an ADS. This is just a different version of that, where you entangle a baby universe with ADS. So what does this look like? So let's imagine that you're just some observer sitting here in ADS. There's your boundary. And you're in a state which is entangled with this baby universe. So what would you see? Well, it's a little hard to write down the state exactly, only because the geometry that I just described to you is rather complicated. It's more complicated than the thermofield double, for example. But at the level of probe fields in this background, it's easy enough to study. And it turns out that an observer sitting at the origin of this ADS will see an effective temperature. And that effective temperature is related, is bounded by the genus of the baby universe that you're entangled with. So in particular, you see an effective temperature which is below the Hawking-Page phase transition. And the way that I interpret this is that if I'm entangled with a thermal ADS, I can have a large entanglement entropy because there's lots of degrees of freedom in that thermal ADS. But if I'm entangled with a baby universe of some size, then I can't get much entanglement entropy because there's only so many degrees of freedom that I can fit in that baby universe. And indeed, it turns out that as I crank up the size of that baby universe, as I make it more and more topologically complicated, I can get higher and higher effective temperatures here in ADS. Right. And indeed, you can take this further and you can say, well, because I'm in this complicated mixed state from my point of view of an ADS observer, you could ask, how could I infer properties of this baby universe cosmology? And there's sort of a decoding map where I can infer properties of this baby universe by investigating properties of the mixed state that I see here in ADS. Good. So that's a little story about wormholes and their interpretation of Lorentzian signature. But the real question that I think we should all be asking ourselves now is, in an actual UV complete theory of gravity, this of course is not dual to an ensemble. It's dual to theory with individual couplings. And how could this possibly happen in a theory which includes a low energy limit that has wormhole solutions, okay? So in order to understand that, we really need a model which has wormholes in the low energy approximation that are then removed by stringy effects. And so I'd like to give a kind of relatively simple model of that. So I'm going to focus not on the sort of wormholes that I described to you previously, which were supported by a potential energy, but instead wormholes that were supported by a kinetic energy. Okay? So in particular, in a typical supergravity theory, you have gravity with a negative cosmological constant coupled to a bunch of scalars. Here, these are massless scalars that, from the dual point of view, parameterize some moduli space of CFTs. And there's a sigma model metric for the scalars, and that's just the Zamolodchikov metric on the space of conformal field theories. And the crucial thing, and the reason why people study axion wormholes, is that although normally we think of that metric on the space of CFTs as a Euclidean metric, that's sort of guaranteed by the unitarity of the theory, if you wanted to think about this in Euclidean gravity, then you'll get a Lorentzian metric on the space of conformal field theories. And that happens because if you have an axion in the theory, axions are parity odd under t goes to minus t, so they have to pick up an I when you go to Euclidean time. You know, t goes to minus t for an axion picks up a minus sign under t goes to minus t, so it picks up an I when t goes to it. So that means that a typical conformal field theory in the bulk will be dual to a supergravity theory, where for the purpose of constructing Euclidean wormholes, we have a Lorentzian target space rather than a Euclidean target space. And these axions will couple to parity odd couplings in the theory, like F wedge F. And it turns out you can find axion wormholes. They take the same kind of form that I described earlier, where you have an FRW form for the metric, and the scalar fields, now the axions, as well as the scalars, will roll as you go from one boundary to the other. And it turns out they need to follow a Lorentzian path through this moduli space of CFTs. It's easy enough to show that they have to follow a geodesic with respect to the Zamolodchikov metric on the space of CFTs, and it has to be a Lorentzian geodesic. And the non-trivial thing is that in order to build a wormhole, remember what I told you at the beginning of our talk, in order to build a wormhole, you need enough energy density here to support the bounce of the solution, okay? That means that you need to be traveling with sufficient velocity through the moduli space of conformal field theories. And that places a bound on the distance between those two points in the space of CFTs that can be related by one of these axion wormholes. And this, I think, this not exactly this formula, but this general idea was described in this beautiful paper by Arkani Hamed, Rogera, and Polchinski, as well as some other many other papers over the years, many of which were authored by Bergschoff and Van Riet. Now, the classic example is an axiodilaton moduli space, which when you do this Lorentzian continuation, looks like the metric has this form. So this is the string theory dilaton. This is the axion. We have the string coupling squared here, along with the minus sign, because we're working in Euclidean spacetime. And of course, this is nothing more or less than the planar patch of ADS2. And as you may know from your study of ADS space, the longest time-like geodesic has length pi squared, which does not fall inside this bound, okay? And that's why axion wormholes are hard to find in string theory. But there is something sort of crazy that you could do, which is that in supergravity, you could do a field redefinition to go to global coordinates on the space of conformal field theories, which corresponds to a field redefinition of your axiodilaton. And this would lead you to construct a wormhole that now goes through global ADS rather than just the planar patch of ADS2. And what this would look like is a wormhole that has a region where G string becomes negative. Okay? Now, you might think that that's insane, and you might be right. But the point is that a naive supergravity observer would think this is fine, because a naive supergravity observer doesn't care about the sign of g-string, because Newton's constant is proportional to g-string squared. Okay? So this wormhole that I've described here is an axionic wormhole that, to the point of view of a supergravity observer, looks perfectly fine. It's got weak couplings, everything's moving slowly, it's great. But of course, if you're a string theorist, you care about the sign of g-string. And the reason is that there are objects in your theory, namely d-brains, whose tension goes like 1 over g string, not 1 over g string squared. Okay? So what that means is that this supergravity wormhole, once you go to string theory, there's going to be a surface here where suddenly g string goes from being very small and positive to very small and negative, which means that the tension of d strings goes from being very large and positive to being very large and negative. And so you'll sort of generate a cap to your geometry built out of these d-brains. And my speculation is that this is something like the half wormhole of string theory, where this naive supergravity wormhole looks instead like two quasi-wormholes in string theory that are capped off by a collection of d-brains. Okay, I think it's time for me to wrap up. Good, Jason, you can put down the sign. So the conclusion, wormholes, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Wormholes are ubiquitous. You can't ignore them. But you're glad you didn't ignore them, because they're crucial to explain the emergence of semi-classical gravity. But exactly how they disappear in UV complete theories is a bit of a mystery. But I've described here today a couple of simple models where we can understand some of these things quite precisely. Thank you.
Time for maybe one question.
Sorry for going over.
No worries.
We have a question from Don. You can unmute yourself and talk.
Thanks. I'll try to keep this short. So, Alex, I got confused during the part of your talk where you were talking about entanglement with the baby universe, because the way that I understand entanglement with the baby universe, it's always of the form associated with the what you would have called the random coupling constants in the theory, meaning that the entanglement represents just the fact that you have the same ensemble of coupling constants in the baby universe as in the bulk, and it's usually not possible to do further entanglement. In other words, the entanglement is usually something that's only seen if you take a sort of non-physical super observer point of view, and you talk about superpositions of super selection sectors. But you talked about an observer experiencing this.
Yeah, this is a much more vanilla thing than, for example, I think what you have in mind, maybe your paper with Henry or something like that. This is literally just a Euclidean geometry with a spatial slice that has two disconnected components on the surface of vanishing extrinsic curvature. And so, this is not so different from, say, the construction of the thermal field double by looking at the spatial slice, where I have two disconnected ADSs on the spatial slice connected by a Euclidean geometry. Sorry, I don't know, maybe by a Euclidean
I understand the construction.
Yeah.
My question is really, are you sure of the interpretation? Because I would have thought there were general arguments, not saying you couldn't find this as a saddle to something, but that if you did, what it represented was entanglement in the sense of having, again, common coupling constants, common super selection sectors, or something that is not observable. And there are various island type arguments that would back that up. Okay. So I guess it's a question of how sure you are of the interpretation.
I mean, I think that there is at the level of the Euclidean geometry, having a Lorentzian slice where I can give it this interpretation, that's absolutely 100% clear. There may be fancier arguments involving super selection sectors. Like, let's put it this way. You might be able to define super selection, a theory with super selection sectors where such a thing can't happen. Okay. I'd be happy to talk about that more, but I don't know if I have anything contentful to say. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Alex.
Let's thank Alex again.
Great.